We'd like to introduce Kenneth Mann. Mr. Mann, if you'd rise, please. Mr. Mann is the National Public Defender of the Ministry of Justice of the State of Israel and is here visiting with our own State Public Defender's Office on a program to learn more about State Public Defenders and perhaps do training in this state. For state public defenders, and we're delighted to have you and have international recognition of the state of Wisconsin's public defender's office. And we're going to hear, as you know, from an assistant attorney general and an assistant state public defender, and of course you might include in your visits visit with the Attorney General's office to see how they handle the State Public Defender's Office. So with that said, right, welcome, Mr. Mann. With that said, you both will have to be on your best behavior. Our third case is 97-1426, C.R. State versus Daniel G. Scheidel. I'm Mr. Freiman. Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I am Assistant Attorney General James Freiman, representing petitioner state of Wisconsin. Excuse me. This case is before the court on the state's petition for review of an adverse decision of the Court of Appeals. Defendant Daniel Scheidel was convicted in 1995 by a Racine County jury of attempted first-degree sexual assault while masked, and burglary of a dwelling while armed and masked, both crimes part of a single episode. The principal issue today is an evidentiary one, whether the trial court properly excluded the defendant's proffered evidence that some unknown third party committed an allegedly similar crime 5 weeks after the charged episode and 4 or 5 blocks away in downtown Racine. The Court of Appeals reversed in a published decision, concluding that the evidence should have come in. Part of the impetus for the state being here today, in addition, obviously, to disagreeing with the Court of Appeals' result in this matter, is a concern that the Court of Appeals' Scheidel decision now has introduced some uncertainty into the governing law in the area of third-party evidence and other acts evidence. We now essentially have three possible tests that a trial court would have to consider when it is dealing with third-party evidence. The prevailing test since 1984, as articulated in State versus Denny, is the legitimate tendency test that provides for the admission of third-party evidence if certain prerequisites are met, namely motive, opportunity, and direct connection. We also have, under the rules of evidence, for other acts evidence, a standard that says that when the state wants to introduce other acts evidence against the defendant for purposes of proving identity, the state must meet a modus operandi standard. Now, the Court of Appeals in Scheidel has suggested that for certain third-party evidence that the defendant wants to present, where that evidence is other acts evidence, and where the defendant wants to use it for identity, that somehow this is different from the Denny test, that the Denny test only applies to motive evidence. And it's different from the other acts test that applies to the state when the state wants to introduce other acts evidence on identity. Now I have a third test that says probative value versus prejudice. For trial courts now, it's difficult for trial courts.
Could you summarize? You started off by saying there were three possible tests. Can you give them to me, quick shorthand? What are the three tests?
Sure.
The Denny test.
The state's position is that two of them apply here. First, the Denny,
test. I just want the three tests.
I understand.
Okay.
The Denny test is the overriding test, and that is that before evidence can come in, when it's third-party evidence proffered by a defendant, the defendant has to meet three things. He has to show that the third party possessed a motive to do the crime, that the third party had opportunity to commit the crime, and that a direct connection exists between the third party and the criminal act. And that test asks, and this is quoting Denny here, whether the proffered evidence is so remote in time, place, or circumstances that a direct connection cannot be made between the third person and the crime. Now, the Denny test, in its formulation, also includes some prejudice, some balancing of... The second test is the other acts evidence test that now is applying to this, that is applied to the state for identity evidence under 904.04 sub 2. That test, which this court articulated in Fishnick, I believe, and I want to give you a quote on this, that was a test that was articulated in the context of the state offering other acts evidence on identity against the defendant, and that test is, quote, from Fishnick, there should be such a concurrence of common features and so many points of similarity between the other acts and the crime charged that it can reasonably be said that the other acts and the present act constitute the imprint of the actor, and I substitute the word actor here for defendant. And now the Court of Appeals in this case says...
This is the third
one. No,
this
is the third one. This is probative versus prejudice.
Probative versus prejudice.
That's what the Court of Appeals said here.
That's correct.
And what is that test?
That test basically says that if the third-party evidence is being offered on identity or misidentification, that all the defendant has to do to gain admissibility is to show that it's probative value, that it has some probative value, some relevance, that outweighs prejudice to the opposing party in terms of the 904.03 analysis, confusion of issues, misleading the jury, unfair prejudice to the opposing party of the state. The state's position...
Is that what the trial judge did here?
The trial judge applied a straight Denny analysis, I think. There was some discussion, actually. At the time of trial, the trial court said, can't meet the Denny test. We don't even know who this third party is. How can the defendant show opportunity if we don't even know who that is, that the person had the opportunity to commit the charged crime?
A general motive wouldn't be sufficient enough. You'd have to show the individual that motive. Is that true?
That's my understanding, right. And I think part of the problem with the Court of Appeals analysis here is that it tries to make a distinction between motive and identity that I've wrestled with, but I can't see that distinction. When a defendant under Denny is offering evidence to show that some third party or a host of third parties had motive, the Denny test says, not good enough, it's just bare suspicion, unless you can also show opportunity and direct connection.
Now, Denny was a murder.
That's correct.
And in that murder case, trying to show that other people had motives.
That's correct.
They could have been the killer. So, and motive is generally good evidence in a criminal case on homicide.
It could be.
Okay. And so motive became an important aspect. That's why they looked at motive. Who else would have had a motive to kill? They looked at who else had the opportunity to kill. And then they looked for a connection.
Right.
Now, is the connection under Denny similar to the modus operandi kind of concept under what you view as the second issue?
Yes, I believe it's very similar.
Okay, I have a question for you on that. Let's just turn this case around a bit and have that the state is trying to introduce this evidence because he had been arrested or charged with or accused of. You don't need a conviction, right?
Right.
Of a different rape. And the modus operandi was what? Going through a bathroom window?
Well, there's some dispute as to the mode of entry. But
one mode of entry might have been through a window.
Sure.
Okay. And wearing a mask.
Right.
What else? Any other similarities?
Weapon, a knife.
Both had knives. Okay, what else?
Time of day?
At night, early morning.
Early morning, okay. Early morning, and he's a nurse. What else?
The description, although in this particular case, the victim identified the defendant positively, but the other acts case was one where could be a white man. She wasn't sure because she only heard the voice, didn't see
okay.
the face.
So
average build.
I remember a case that we had where the state introduced, and this court permitted it, evidence of a rapist. And his modus operandi was he used the garage and that he put down his jacket on which the victim was placed. I can't remember the others, but that was admitted. You think on the basis of our cases that here, if the state was introducing this evidence, would the state introduce such evidence under 904.042?
Of course, my argument is if it tried that, it shouldn't come in, that there's not enough similarities. There's too few similarities, and the similarities that are identified are too ordinary to make it an imprint of the perpetrator, that you could comfortably say that that same person did both of these.
We've had cases where the guy drives by and says some words to 15 and 8 to 17 year olds, and then is charged with sexual assault of a much younger person, and that's been admitted. State argued for all of those. They were here.
Right, but I guess I would submit that under this particular case, the factors just don't add up. Now, without knowing the specifics of the other cases, I don't know if there may be something unique about that you could really point to. And
car talking out of a car window.
Probably not unique enough.
But was it established alleged that this defendant came in through the window?
That was... The state's position was that he entered with a key through the door. There was some debate about that at trial in the evidence, that initially what happened in this case was the victim was awakened by the blinds falling from the bathroom window. She got up, went, and closed that bathroom window. This window is a casement window that opens in, and it's 9 feet above the sidewalk below, exposed to view in the community, in the city, downtown Racine. And when she did that, she looked around, saw nobody, heard nothing else, figured the wind had done it, and so she again secured that window. Before she had completely fallen back to sleep, she found this man on top, felt this man on top of her. And so there was a discussion as to how that person got in. And the debate was, and the defendant's position was, when the police questioned him, and this victim was adamant that, I could identify him, I called him by his nickname, this was the guy who did it, that his response was to the police, well, what about that bathroom window? Somebody could have come in through there. So there was some debate about that. And our position is, the state's position at trial, and again here, is that that was unlikely because of the circumstances of where the window was, that it would have awakened her if somebody had tried to get in through that window, that the more probable scenario was entry via the key that the defendant had.
So, but this is to follow up on the Chief Justice's question. The points of similarity, it is night, there is a mask, there is a knife, but it is not necessarily a point of similarity that there was a window entry.
Right, that is one of the distinctions, I think, dissimilarities here. I mean, I think there's a question whether that really is a similarity.
I would ask your opposing counsel in due course to name every single point of similarity. Are there any points of dissimilarity?
Yes, there are several, and these are enumerated in the brief, but I'll summarize them here. First view I've identified is, and that is the mode of entry, the differences in that respect. The second factor is the concealments. It's not surprising that somebody who's bent on burglarizing a residence with intent to commit a sexual assault would try to hide their identity. But the fact is, in the two cases here, the concealments were different. In the other axe case, the later case, the victim reported that the perpetrator was wearing a gray sweatshirt with a draping hood and possibly a white mask. In this case, the complainant said that the defendant was wearing a black knit ski mask with cutout holes for eyes and mouth, and a purple and green nylon jacket tied around his head. So that's a distinction that I think, even if you're going to say that concealment was involved here, that's not unexpected, but the type of concealments were different. Another factor here was the weapons themselves. Not surprising also that somebody bent on forcing an attack on a person would use some kind of a weapon, even a knife. The easiest thing to find, perhaps, in an apartment. But the knives in these cases, there's nothing distinctive about them, and they were different. In the other act case, the later case, the knife was described as smooth-edged, long-bladed, and dirty. like a butcher knife with a dull blade. In fact, it apparently was so dull that the victim in the other axe case could push it away and not be cut by it. In this case, the complainant said the knife was a big kitchen steak knife with a serrated edge, and she did sustain cuts when she tried to push that knife away or resist. But perhaps the most compelling dissimilarity here is the behavior of the intruders when they were inside the apartments. In the other axe case, the intruder spoke to the complainant, directing her to stay down and not scream. He verbally agreed not to assault her anally, and he took the unusual step of asking her name. He never struck her. He was communicative. He expressed at least some consideration when the victim protested. In the present case, the victim reported that the intruder immediately and persistently hit her about the head and face, yet never uttered a word, even after she called out the defendant's nickname, causing this guy to pull back and hesitate. Even after she put up a fight and trained a gun on him, he never said a word. The behavior here actually appeared as much to intended to perhaps humiliate or degrade the complainant in this case as it was for sexual gratification on the part of the intruder.
How would the defendant have proved opportunity on the Denny test?
Where the third party, the other act of the third party, is that person is unknown. Obviously, it's impossible to prove that that person would have been there. And that's why we think the modus test is so necessary in this situation, and part of the reason. And that is that if this truly is a modus crime, if this truly is something that meets these common similarities and of circumstances, that in that situation, you can infer that probably it's good enough to say that this other person, to create a reasonable doubt that this other person could have been the intruder and not the defendant, that it would have been good enough then. We don't worry about opportunity. It's covered enough in that situation. But where it's an unknown person, if it's short of modus, then you've got speculation. And that's what we're trying to keep out here, is speculative evidence rather than really probative evidence.
So does motive play a part under Denny in this third party?
Sure. I think here you can, although as I suggested, there perhaps is differences in the behaviors that would suggest different motives at work, but the fact that there was an attack of some sexual degree would suggest a similarity of motive.
Okay, so that really sort of drops out here.
Correct.
Okay, so what drops out from Denny is motive and opportunity.
Well, it doesn't drop out except that I'm saying that if the modus, that in order for you to satisfy Denny, you have to satisfy the modus test.
Okay, wait. Motive, though, is irrelevant here.
Right.
An opportunity for another person is irrelevant because we don't know who he is.
But I don't think it's irrelevant. I just think that you can't prove it.
Okay.
I understand. Go ahead.
It's a zero. We'll put it in and we put zero next to it, okay? Which leaves us with connection. Okay. How does connection under Denny differ from your modus operandi identity under 904042?
Okay, the Denny test is broader in the sense that it applies to any kind of third-party evidence, not just other acts evidence. In this situation, we're talking about other acts evidence that goes to identity, and for that reason, the modus test, in this particular circumstance, where that's what's being offered, has to be met.
Well, does Denny, in its connection concept, overrule the concept that where you've got identity, that the connection should be the same as under 904042?
It doesn't overrule it. It just provides the framework for dealing with third-party evidence. And then when you get to the specific problem of other acts evidence on identity, that's where I'm saying that you need to have the modus test met in order to satisfy Denny. Otherwise, you get bare suspicion about some unknown third party.
Why don't you just say Denny doesn't apply? I mean, it seems like you're doing lots of contortions. Denny dealt with a known third person. So here we have unknown person or person. So did the third person have the motive to act? Well, we don't know because we don't know who the third person is. Did the third person have the opportunity to act? We don't know. Was there a direct connection between the third person and the act? We don't know who the third person is. Those are the three tests. So why would you just scrap Denny
Sure. I think the determinative thing here is the MODIS test. But what I'm saying is Denny at least provides this overarching framework. And granted, what happened here was the trial court probably got confused and didn't look closely enough here at MODIS and the other acts test for identity.
Well,
I'm sorry.
Are you here to say that Denny does apply, or are you here to say that Denny doesn't?
I'm here to say that it provides this overall framework whenever you've got third-party evidence, and that the MODIS test comes in when that third-party evidence is other acts evidence of the third party.
So, when there's other acts of third party, motive, opportunity, direct connection, are zeros when the third party is unknown, and the only thing you have left is the MODIS test.
For identity. This is for identity. And actually, I mean, the Denny test is really a test that is designed to go to identity anyway, I believe. Because if you're just offering evidence that somebody has a motive, a whole host of people, it really isn't very probative. That's what Denny is set up to address. Unless you're really saying that this person could have done it or this person did it.
Can you explain legitimate tendency as a test? What does that mean? That came out of Denny.
Legitimate tendency? I think the best way to describe it is in, let's see if I can find it here quickly, is the way they talk about the direct connection element. It has three elements: legitimate tendency, motive, opportunity, and direct connection. But the focus is primarily on direct connection. And to quote again, the test asks whether the proffered evidence is so remote in time, place, or circumstances that a direct connection cannot be made between the third person and the crime. And I'm suggesting here that that test provides this overall framework, and that when you get now to other acts evidence of this third party, that it's important that that evidence satisfy the same MODIS test that applies to the state. Otherwise, you don't meet Denny. It's all you're doing is casting a bare suspicion on some third party that you don't even know. And that's the state's position in this case.
So, how do you get the direct connection? Benin here says, I didn't do this act, and I clearly didn't do the next act because I was in jail, so we know I didn't do that. So the defendant is now saying, because these two crimes have so many similar elements or items, therefore we can, at least the jury can be asked, didn't the same person commit them? And the same person cannot be I, right?
Well,
I mean, that's what he's saying.
That's what he's saying, right.
Okay. Now, as a test, you would agree with that. I mean, you won't agree that in this case that they're so similar, but you'd agree that that's the test.
The test, the bar has to be set at a certain level of degree of similarity so that we keep out speculative evidence and don't get verdicts right. Based on unsupported speculation.
Remote in time, place, or circumstances.
Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you agree on the test, you don't agree that whether it's applied here. Oh, I'm going to ask him if he agrees with that test.
I think so. He'd have to speak for himself, but I'm not sure if the defense is agreeing that a MODIS test is the high standard. I would point out, though, actually, in rereading the post-conviction transcript here when the defendant was arguing for a reversal or a new trial, defense counsel did argue that MODIS was the proper test, that this was just a reverse use of 904.04.2 on identity.
While you were just discussing, all I could think about was the Witte case, which gave you the similarities that were unique to be able to say that the defendant had committed all those crimes. Is there any Witte test to be applied here, or have we got another test? We got so many tests, it might get a little confusing for trial judges.
Well, the Witte is the genesis, if you will, of this MODIS test. That's where it stems from. The Witte test says that when other acts evidence is offered to prove identity, that's where it becomes so important that you have so many common similarities, or at least some unique similarities, that you can comfortably say that it's the imprint, the same crime, that crime and the other crime are the same imprint. Didn't articulate that quite right, but I...
Mr. Freimuth, let's assume for a minute that we decide that the legitimate tendency test, the Denny test, is not the appropriate test here. So that the judge committed error. You've argued in your brief that the error, if there was error, was harmless. Why do you think that's true?
That was just what I was going to articulate, was the second part.
ESP.
Must be, right. Pardon me a second here, Ollie. In this case, the evidence that at trial from the complainant was that this wasn't a stranger assault, that she was able to identify the defendant as her assailant based on his eyes, his body structure and movement, noting that he has a very distinctive body structure and walk. She was able to dislodge part of his ski mask to see the left side of his face. Now, this is a person that she had been the supervisor of, or boss of, if you will, for 9 months. This is a person that had been living in the same apartment building with her, one flight above, who had helped her paint her bathroom, who she had socialized with. In addition to this positive identification, there's circumstantial corroboration in several respects. Each time she called out the defendant's nickname, Dano, during the attack, the assailant would pull back and hesitate. The man never spoke a word to her, even after she threatened him with a gun. He had managed and arranged to keep a key to her apartment beyond the normal. He apparently had helped around this apartment building and had occasionally would have keys to other apartments, but in this case, the owner or landlord had had to ask him about returning the key because he had kept it, and he still had it at this point. And he had shown both an interest in and an animus towards this particular victim on that very night. They were supposed to meet at the restaurant where they worked, and he became upset when she didn't pay him the attention that he wanted. And he thereafter says, for the first time ever, that I'll give you a wake-up call the next morning, even though he didn't have to get up. So there's a lot of circumstances here that would support her identification of him, and so that even if you were to say that this other act's evidence of this unknown third party should have come in, I would submit that there's no reasonable possibility that it would have affected the jury's verdict.
He also mentioned a potential sexual act to her, also, didn't he, as far as calling her name? And
yes, he used some derogatory language toward her in that vein, correct. Thank
she
you.
She struggled?
She did struggle, right.
He showed no bruises.
He showed no bruises when the police immediately examined him, that's correct. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Freimuth. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Cooper, Mitchell Cooper, Assistant State Public Defender, representing the defendant.
May it please the court. My name is Mitchell Cooper of the Office of the State Public Defender, and I represent the respondent in this case, Daniel Scheidel. Although in this case, the state had the opportunity to introduce evidence to show that the defendant was the person who committed this crime, Mr. Scheidel, on the other hand, was not afforded the opportunity to introduce highly relevant evidence to show that he didn't. This despite the fact that the only issue in this case was identity. What he sought to introduce was evidence of this second, very similar crime. They were so similar that it led the trial court to acknowledge on the morning of the first day of trial that they're strikingly similar. In answer to Justice Prosser's earlier question, there were a number of notable characteristics that both of these crimes shared, a number of characteristics that petitioner did not explain yet to the court. I'd like to fill the court in on those. They didn't simply happen at the same time of day or roughly the same time of day. They happened almost precisely at the same moment, between 5 o'clock and 5:30 a.m. They happened not just both in the same town, not just in the same section of town, but in the very same neighborhood, only 4 blocks apart. The suspected point of entry in both cases was a window. There was some discussion a moment ago whether the window was in fact the point of entry in the charge case, and there was significant evidence adduced at trial to suggest that in fact it was. The reason for that being that the victim in the charge case woke up about half an hour or so before the assault took place, and she said that the blinds in her bathroom had fallen. And when she went to check after a few moments, she saw that the window, which had been closed, was now open a foot.
Counsel, I don't want to argue here, but
It seemed to me that that window was open for air prior to the lines blowing off. And if I'm mistaken, say so. That was just my recall and reading.
It opened wider than she had remembered leaving it.
Yeah, that was...
What she did testify to on cross-examination is that the window when she went to check was open a foot wider than it had been before she went to sleep. The other evidence that the entry took place at the window is that there was a handprint that was found right there. And notably, the only place the police dusted for prints in that apartment was in the bathroom. And most significantly, this was the handprint that I discussed at the end of my brief that didn't match the size of Mr. Scheidel's hand.
That window was something like 9 feet off of the ground?
Yes, that's correct. It was 9 feet off the ground, and that's very similar to the distance off the ground that the second apartment had the break-in. In that case, it was a lower second-story apartment building.
Any other similarities?
There were several others. There was a knife in both of these cases. In each case, the victim awoke to find a man straddling her with that knife. In each case, the victim was very similar. It was a single white woman who lived alone in that lower story apartment building. And in both cases, the assailant was shrouded in some way, and he had a mask. It was the fact that he concealed his identity in that way that's significant. Not that he happened to grab a different mask in one case or something else to shroud his head, but in each case, his face was obscured by one article of clothing, and his head was obscured by another. There were same crimes in both cases. There was a burglary, and there was either an attempted or a completed first-degree sexual assault. And in both cases, the description of these...
I take it it was not completed in either event, or we'd have some DNA.
Pardon me, Your Honor?
The sexual assault, I take it, was not a completed act, was it, in either case?
Yes, it was a completed act in the second case. It wasn't a completed act in the first case. It was in that first case that the victim had struggled.
Well,
no one disputes that in the second one it was not this defendant. He was in jail.
That's correct. And that's why this evidence is relevant, because what Mr. Scheidel sought to do in this case was to show that in each case, since it shared this great number of similarities, that one could reasonably infer that they would have been committed by the same person, and that he could not have been that one person because he was in jail at the time that second crime was committed.
I didn't read the record with respect to the extent of the struggle that she put up, which has bearing on the fact that he did not have bruises. What does the record show us in that regard?
She testified that it was a vigorous struggle. She testified that she hit her assailant several times and did it very hard. She testified that the struggle lasted at least a full minute. And she also had a significant number of marks on her. She had some bruises. A photograph of her is contained in the exhibits that were entered into evidence at trial. And she had scrapes. She had a superficial cut on her hand. And what's notable about that is that the victim in this case was 6 feet tall. When the police came to the scene shortly after this assault took place, they spoke with Mr. Scheidel. They spoke to him. One of the officers said that it looked like he had just woken up. And he was wearing sleeping attire. And they examined him for marks that might have been incurred during the struggle with this 6 foot woman. He's slight. He's 5'11 and he's under 55 pounds. He took off his robe and the police examined him carefully. They didn't see any marks, any bruises, any cuts, any scrapes, anything that might have indicated the struggle that the victim in this case had described. Furthermore, they searched his home. And again, this was shortly after the crime was reported, minutes after it was reported. They didn't find anything. They didn't find the mask that was described. They didn't find the shroud over the head that was described. They didn't find a knife. And they searched the apartment carefully.
He did have access to other parts of the building, did he not?
Yes.
And did they search the entire building or just his home?
The police testified that they searched the basement, they searched his home carefully, and they also searched outside the building. And in none of those places was any of these articles found. In addition, the building manager, Ms. Proust, had conducted a search as well. She didn't find anything.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand your answer to Justice Babbage. Was there DNA evidence?
No, there was no DNA evidence in this case.
None of it was.
No, only with the second, act, which is irrelevant because the defendant was not there anyway.
Is the handprint evidence here in front of us?
It is. Yes, it's entered in one of the exhibits. It was not submitted into evidence, but it is in the exhibit package that's made a part of the record.
Are we supposed to be reviewing the trial judge's refusing to accept that?
Yes. That's one of the issues respondent had raised on this appeal. In all, this evidence itself was crucial, and it's made all the more crucial by the fact that there was a significant number of factors that would throw into doubt the reliability of her identification, Mr. Scheidel.
Counsel, before you continue, I understand the state's position. They want to continue with Denny, but they recognize the only real issue here under Denny is connection, which they say equals other acts evidence of third parties, with the same rules applicable to defendant as are applicable to the state, had the state introduced the evidence. Now, just so we get the baseline, do you agree with that as a statement of the law applicable to this case?
Your Honor, I both agree with that and I disagree with it slightly. What I do think is correct as a conceptual framework, when a court decides, when this court or any court decides whether or not to admit similar acts evidence, evidence of another similar crime, one must accept as an analytical framework that which this court put forth last term in State versus Sullivan. That framework is any time that the proponent of the evidence wants to bring in this other crime to show that it was the same perpetrator in each case, there are three factors that must be considered. The first is whether it's being used for a permissible 904.042 exception, meaning whether it's being used to show lack of mistake, intent, knowledge, motive, identity. That's the case here. It's being used for identity. The second question is whether it's relevant to the case. That's also the case here. Identity was not just an issue at trial that was important, it was the determinative issue. And the other prong of that relevance question, this court made clear, was that the proponent must also show that it's probative. In other words, whether that evidence tends to show identity.
Is that part of the second element or third?
I would submit that this is what the time, place, circumstance test is. And this is the very same test that this court had imposed.
Well, is that part of relevancy?
Yes, part of relevancy. The third prong.
Can I keep you on that relevancy for just a moment? Obviously not all relevant evidence has to be admitted. But a great deal is subject to the discretion of the court. I don't recall to the extent how much Sullivan discussed that degree of relevancy that is required. But what do you think is the degree of relevancy?
What Sullivan did require was that what Sullivan talked about, and in fact what other cases that this court has decided talked about, when the state is the proponent of other acts evidence, including in Witte, is the great danger that comes to the defendant when it's introduced against him. The three dangers that the court pointed out are that the jury might be inclined to punish him simply because he's a bad guy, because he committed a crime in the past, and he should be punished for that. The other danger being that the jury might infer that he has a proclivity to commit crimes and that therefore he committed this crime. And the third danger is that it's unfair to attack a defendant with this evidence when he's not prepared to defend himself. Now, these are three dangers that are non-existent when the defendant is the proponent of the evidence. And that's why, conceptually, this other act's evidence is really, at its core, just a test of relevance.
Well, 904.02 says all relevant evidence is admissible, except as otherwise provided by Constitution, statute, etc. Do you think the statute really means that? All, any evidence, the slightest degree of relevant evidence is admissible. Do you think that's what that statute says?
Yes, Your Honor, and this court has agreed with that in State versus Richardson. Okay. That doesn't mean, though, that it's admissible. The next question in deciding whether relevant evidence comes in is whether it should be kicked out by 904.03, which would be any evidence then that could also inflame the jury, confuse the jury, whether it's a waste of time, or whether there's great prejudice. And that's why the standard should be higher when the state introduces this evidence, because there is that great tendency for prejudice against the defendant. And when you conduct that balancing test between relevance on the one hand and prejudice on the other, the relevant factor better be pretty darn high, because the prejudice factor is also very high. For those same three reasons I mentioned a moment ago that the court had listed in a number of its 90404 cases.
So explain to me exactly, and I know that the Court of Appeals laid that out on the probative value of prejudice, and how the state is not prejudiced. Again, just go through that again, so that the state, it's a difference. And just tell me what that difference is.
The prejudice to the defendant, well, the prejudice that inures to the defendant when the state offers this, again, is that the jury might punish the defendant, might think that he has a proclivity to commit this crime, and that it's unfair to spring this on the defendant and essentially force him all of a sudden to defend himself against these other crimes. And that's not present when the defendant is the proponent of this evidence. But I'm not suggesting that, as Justice Babich implied with his question, it's a good question, whether if it's simply relevant, it should come on in. And I'm not saying that's the standard here. In fact, I'm saying it shouldn't come. That's not enough to let it in. That's enough to begin the inquiry. The next question, though, just like any other evidentiary question, is whether this relevant piece of evidence could come in, or if it's overwhelmed by the 90403 factors. Now, in this case, even though those three great prejudices to the defendant aren't present, I'm asking the court to impose a simple relevant standard. That's what the Court of Appeals had decided in this case.
Well, then it seems to me that you're saying, maybe you're not, but that's what I'm hearing, that the standard for letting in modus operandi evidence is less when the defendant is offering it than when the state. That is, you're more stringent to the state than you are to the defendant. Now, as I heard, the state, they want the same test. Are you asking for a different test?
Your Honor, I'm asking for the bar to be lowered. I'm asking for the same test, but for the bar to be lowered. And the reason the bar should be lowered is because the proponent of the evidence in this case doesn't have to leap as high to get over the prejudice.
The bar be lowered with respect to what? Prejudice?
With respect to prejudice. And therefore, for the relevance to outweigh the prejudice, it also doesn't have to be quite as high. Because when the prejudice comes down a little bit, the relevance could also come down a little bit, because it's not outweighed by the great prejudice.
Well, now, what about, you're lowering the bar on that, but you still have the same elements. You would apply the element test the same. That is the similarities.
Yes, I would. I think conceptually, what this court has set forth in a number of cases, State versus Kuntz, for example, is that when you evaluate the similarity of two crimes, look at similarity in time, place, and circumstance. And I think that's something that we would all do intuitively. When we're comparing two crimes, we want to know, well, was one committed in Hawaii and one was committed here? If so, that's not going to be as relevant. Was one committed 30 years ago and one committed yesterday? Again, it's not going to be so relevant. And as far as the circumstances, was the crime itself, the earmarks of that crime, not share a great number of similarities? And if that's the case, then maybe it should come out. But these are all factors that should be worked in together. So if it's less on one, it could be more on the other and still permit entry of the evidence. What I'd like to note, though, is regardless of the standard that this court imposes, it would meet that threshold. Even if this court were to heap upon the defendant the same requirement for introducing similar crimes that have the same degree of similarity that is now required to the state, it would still pass that test. A couple decisions that this court had decided in the past, I think, are instructive in that regard. State versus Spear, the defendant was on trial for burglary. he had entered into a house that had a for sale sign on it. The question in this trial also was identity. And the evidence that the state introduced, it was admitted and this court affirmed, was a prior conviction for a burglary in California 2 years prior that was committed in a house that had a for sale sign. So when we look at the time, place, circumstances of that test, it's quite a bit less convincing than the time, place, and circumstances in this case.
Was that the only element of that was similar, that he did house for sale burglaries?
That's the only one that I noted in my reading of the case. There was another case that would be instructive.
Wasn't that rather like the one where the man did burglaries while the family of a deceased were at the funeral home? But that was his M.O. That's what hung him. And isn't that for sale sign out in front an indication that that's the type of crime he looks for to commit?
It might very well be. But when you look at all these factors together, it becomes less relevant if this is a burglary that happened in California comparing one that happened in Wisconsin. One might fairly infer that, okay, even though they're similar, the circumstances aren't so unique as to lead one to believe it's committed by the same person, and that's even further attenuated by the fact that they happen 2,000 miles apart.
How would the other acts evidence be brought in? Wasn't there a police report or, I mean, that's what I'm trying to get at. Would there be any way to question that evidence?
It could have been brought in by testimony of the police officer. This was a crime that happened at 5 a.m. It was reported at 5:14. Certainly, given the crimes that she just suffered from, the fact that she went to a rape crisis unit, went to a hospital, it's quite possible. I think that in itself is almost prima facie reason to allow it under an excited utterance.
I think that Justice Prosser is saying to you, the victim is going to bring in her evidence here, in this case, against your client. Now, your client wants to bring in another crime. Who is going to testify to that crime? Not the lawyer, right?
Correct.
So you're going to put somebody on the stand. Who's it going to be? It's going to be a police officer from this community, and then the police officer will describe the crime. Is it going to be the second victim who's going to describe the crime? Now, in this case, there was an offer of proof, wasn't there?
Yes.
Is that right? And an issue that we're not handling on this case, if I remember it, is this issue of how would you prove it. Is that right? Or have I confused cases?
This issue of what, Your Honor?
Of how you
how do you prove
how you prove the second crime?
Yeah, that's something that hadn't been addressed fully at the motion hearing before trial.
We limited the issue, isn't it?
And this was also limited by this court.
We just took one issue.
We just took that first issue. Not. Not as to the form of admitting the evidence.
That's correct. Just issue one was accepted by this court for review.
Counsel, are you done with all of that? Okay, I got another question. Under 90403, of course, we talk about, and Sullivan talks about, balancing the probative value against unfair prejudice. But the statute goes on, and we've got to balance probative value against other factors. Confusion of the issue, misleading the jury, undue delay, waste of time, etc. Is the bar also lowered with respect to these, or are those the same considerations we would apply? Would we apply them with equal force to the state?
I think those should be applied equally. I don't see any reason on the horizon why it is that that would either be less of a factor or more of a factor for a defendant, other than perhaps his constitutional right to present evidence.
So only prejudice is the bar lowered.
That's the part that differs significantly when it comes to other crimes evidence, and that this court has repeatedly pointed out in its cases.
Now, I asked you, but I'm not sure I understood or heard your answer. You would then go along with Denny, because motive becomes zero here, opportunity becomes zero, so you're in with connection. The connection is the same test of modus operandi for the state and the defendant, and the only place you differ with the state, as I hear it, is on probative versus prejudice.
That's correct. That's correct. Because what it boils down to is a simple test of relevance. And at its core, that's the analysis anytime the state introduces 90404 to other acts evidence. For the reasons that I pointed out earlier in this court's decision in Sullivan, that it is at bottom a test of relevance, and the reason the standard is so high is because the prejudice has a commensurate high level.
So counsel, I'm just trying to imagine, so if the simple test of relevance, and this happened, let's just change the facts, 2 miles away rather than 4 or 5 blocks, a little different in time, if we have the same modus operandi, and all the testimony comes in that the state talks about the fact that Kim, the other person who claimed the rape, had been, this is like the 6th or 7th time that she had called the police. And so the jury is going to hear a completely different crime. And you're saying that confusion, that the bar of confusion or the consideration could be the same. I find that, I'm just trying to imagine that the confusion that the jury may have, even though this is relevant, it just seems to allow a lot of additional, quote, evidence to come in. Basically, is this relevant because it's similar in time, place, etc. Explain that to me. You say that the confusion argument would be the same state or defense, Whitney or Sullivan or the legitimate tendency test.
Correct. In this case, the only issue was one of identity. I can't fathom that the jury in this case would lose track of the ball. It would be able to keep in mind that this is coming in for the purpose of identity. It would know that what the defendant is doing with this evidence is showing that since they're so similar, one person committed this crime, that it wasn't me because I was in jail, and therefore this goes to identity. There's really nothing complex about that.
What I see is that we have had the presentation of yourself and opposing counsel, and there already is, quote, some confusion on the similarity or dissimilarity of the particular act in question here. In other words, one wore this, one wore that, you had a knife, one was different type of knife, one said something, one didn't say anything, one could have come in under a key, one obviously came up, supposedly came in through the window, although that's alleged in the case in chief. That's what I'm talking about, the confusion that the jury could have with making this a simple relevance bar. In other words, that's the decision the trial court would have to make.
Your Honor, I believe this is the very same kind of evidence that the jury is going to have to sort through whether or not the defendant's evidence comes in. And in fact, all these factors that you mentioned, we can consult the record, and this is information that was brought out at trial. So it wouldn't require any additional factors. It really wouldn't require any additional issues at all. And therefore, it would still be easy for the jury to follow.
Mr. Cooper, let's assume that indeed the trial judge applied the wrong test. The evidence should have come in. How do you handle the state's argument that this was harmless error, that the evidence is so overwhelming that it was harmless error in this case?
I think the evidence wasn't at all overwhelming. In this case, the evidence was almost solely, or the conviction was based almost solely on her saying that it was Mr. Scheidel who did it. And yet she said this after she just woke up, when her room was fairly dark, her blinds were completely closed. She wears contact lenses. She didn't wear contact lenses. She didn't have glasses on when this took place. The whole struggle lasted about a minute. And he was masked. The whole time she said that she never saw anything on his face, no features of his face other than the eyes. And when she said eyes, she was referring to the eyeballs themselves, not any features of the eyes further than that.
Were those arguments made to the jury in closing argument, that her identification was faulty for the reasons that you're telling us about now?
Yes. Yes. And if the jury had the additional important information that, well, maybe she's just wrong about that, and here is important proof, then it could very well have gone the other way. I think it would have gone the other way.
There was a partial unmasking, but she did observe his side of his face.
That's correct. For just a moment, she said, a portion of the mask went askew. But she also testified that she didn't see the lips, she didn't see the teeth, she didn't see the nose, she didn't see an eye. At that moment, it was just, what I'm inferring from the record, was just a small portion of the cheek.
Is the police report from the second incident in the record?
Yes, it is. It's included as an exhibit to Mr. Scheidel's post-conviction motion.
Said she wore contact lenses. Was she nearsighted or farsighted?
It was the victim in the first case, the charge case, that wore contact lenses.
Yeah.
I don't think that was adduced at trial. I don't think that it's clear from the record whether she was near or farsighted.
Well, if I took these glasses off, I could barely see you. But I can read with my glasses off. I mean, I think that would make a big difference, wouldn't it?
Well, we also don't know how nearsighted she was, if in fact it was nearsighted. But it is a factor that leads to considerable doubt. She needs some aid in vision. She didn't have it when this happened. The handprint evidence also, in this case, goes to whether or not there was harmless error. This is further evidence that he didn't do it. The handprint that was on the wall, the expert or the police officer at trial testified that it wasn't clear whether it came from any particular person. And he said so because the quality of the print wasn't good enough to examine that. Couldn't check the whorls, couldn't check the quality of the print, but he could check the size, and he says that it's clear that it comes from an adult male.
Were there any handprints at the other site?
None that I've seen on the police report.
How can you say that it came from an adult male?
He was judging that relative to his own hand. He put it up against the handprint. He thought that it was about the same size, and he was judging then that it's an adult male.
How does that help your client? He's an adult male, isn't he?
He is an adult male. This was another issue that's been raised in the respondent's brief. He prepared a handprint also, and he wanted the jury to see the relative sizes, the print that was lifted from the scene and the size of his own print. And the trial court kept this out.
What was it, smaller or bigger?
Smaller.
His own handprint was smaller.
His whole hand, and I believe...
Did he do that in the presence of somebody or the court or anybody else?
He did it out of court. He did it in his lawyer's office, and when he was testifying on direct examination, the lawyer asked him about that. Asked him when he prepared this, whether he pressed hard.
Well, he didn't prepare it in the presence of the lawyer.
He prepared it in the presence of the lawyer, but outside the presence of the courtroom, outside the presence of the jury.
What evidence was there that the handprint that was left on the wall was attributable to the attacker?
I see my time has expired. May I leave the court to answer this question? The fact that this was a suspected point of entry, not just because of the information, this isn't clear that it was suspected because this is what the victim said, that she heard the blinds fall, that the window was open wider, but it's clear that this is what the police believe to be the suspected point of entry because there was no other place in the apartment that was dusted for prints. It was only in the bathroom. This is where the suspicion was centered.
Was the handprint on the window or the wall?
It was on the wall right next to the window.
The bathroom.
In the bathroom. There are no further questions.
It was not the victim's.
I don't think there was any evidence in the record to suggest one way or the other, other than the size of that print.
Counsel. Are there any further questions?
Thank you.
Hearing none, thank you, Mr. Cooper. Mr. Freiman, you have a few moments in rebuttal.
Was there any physical evidence introduced against the defendant?
Physical evidence? I don't think so. There was nothing left behind at the crime scene, in other words, in terms of serological evidence.
No, hair. No scraping under her fingernails?
Not as far as I know, right. I think it was identification was the primary basis.
No hair on the bed? Not that I recall.
Were her fingernails scraped?
I do not know if that's in the record or not.
When was this assault? What day? I mean, what year and month? Just remind me.
I believe it occurred in October of 95. No, it occurred in May. I'm sorry, May of... Yeah, the trial was in 95. I'm sorry, May of 94, I think.
Okay.
And it was a...
So
it was
the use
a,
of DNA evidence was much more limited.
Right.
That's right. It was in place, but it was just in its infancy, I believe. That's right, the DNA.
But of course, if there were scrapings and there were no scratches on the body of the defendant, that would be quite relevant, wouldn't it?
Sure. But as I say, I don't think there was anything like that introduced, not in my recollection at trial. I just wanted to start with a comment about the MODIS test again, because I think there still may be some confusion as to the party's positions. Our position is that with respect to the MODIS test, that unless the defendant meets that test, which is the test that now applies to the state for other acts evidence, and we're talking about other acts that go to identity, that unless that test is met, unless that standard is met, you've got problems both with the probative value, in other words, the relevancy of that evidence, as well as the potential prejudice to the state. And I wanted to articulate some of that prejudice, that harm, if that bar isn't there. The harm is that if that bar isn't set high enough, what you're going to have is you're opening the door to present in potentially all sorts of kinds of criminal activity that may just have some similarity, that may not be don't come close to modus operandi, but it's relevant under the Court of Appeals test because it has some marginal probative value. The problem with that is that then you're giving the jury, you're talking about an event that occurred at a different time and place than the charged crime. You're giving the jury bare suspicion that this third party did it, speculation. And the state has a compelling interest, just like the defendant, in a reliable and efficient trial, determination of guilt or innocence. In this situation, if it's not raised, the bar isn't that high for this evidence to get in, this other X evidence, a judge cannot direct a verdict against the defendant. So an acquittal, even an unreasonable or erroneous acquittal, is not reviewable. The state cannot review an erroneous acquittal. To avoid that, that's why it's so important to avoid admitting speculative evidence, third-party evidence in the first instance. The other concern, as I say, is with the risk of confusion to the jury. Now, in this case, we have a single incident, but even in a single incident, you've got, depending on how this is presented to the jury, you have the prospect of the jury confusing what happened in this other case with what happened in the present case. You've got concerns about...
That's the same kind of confusion as if the state had introduced the evidence.
Sure, and that's why the bar is that high. It doesn't come in unless it meets that MODIS test. It is then very probative evidence, and it is then warranted for both parties to have to address it with that under that circumstance. A couple of other comments and a little bit different.